coming. Interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
A very good Wednesday. Race fans, Sirius 219 XM 201 Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website, stevebeck.com. Absolutely perfect day. It's officially the start of the second half of the season, day 21, and it took about this long to, you know, to get the kind of day we love in upstate New York. I'd love to be at the track broadcasting today, because Tom Amos is going to be with us, and he could have been sitting across from me, and Joe Clancy later, so Joe would have been a live visit. But I got to go back to the dentist. I got the follow up. It's been actually postponed a couple of times from that stupid cracked tooth. Yesterday was the tail of the cat, and this is the tail of the Jordan Almond. there will never be there will never be another Jordan Almond to consume by me. I learned my lesson. So anyway, I got the only thing they could do was get me at 12:40, and technically I could have thrown the equipment and you know, hightailed it over here, back over. It's in Greenwich. So I said, all right, we'll go tomorrow and live tomorrow for the weekend preview, which is brought to you by Twin Spires. The opportunity to have Dave Greinke, of course, and we've got Chuck and Barry. Chuck and Barry. Barry arrives later today, Barry Spears and Chuck, so they'll sit in. Hammer went home, so Hammer leaves, and in comes the next set of guest hosts. Well, of course, Chuck had already guest hosted. Anyway, so racetrack tomorrow. And I think, as far as I know, we're in for another... I threw away all the MTOs because, yeah, it, absolutely perfect. The next 3 days, and amazing. The first show of potential wet weather is Monday, dark day. So it should be a fabulous weekend. They drew the Saturday card, which features, of course, the Grade One 4-star Dave, and I mean the two stakes. I mean, this is becoming a little bit of a repetitious refrain. But small stake fields with good horses, and the 4-star Dave, which is of course the most recent vintage Grade One upstate. Where'd it go? What did I do? Oh, that's Friday. That's Friday. I'm, there we go. Saturdays. I'm like, why isn't the 4-star Dave where it's supposed to be? There it is. 4-star Dave. Five in here. And the two Grade One winning stars. Regal Glory, of course. And Casa Creed. So it's a headline matchup between the two of them. Then there's Grade One placed Mason for Judma and Chad Brown. And there's also Get Smokin' for Mark Cassie for the Iron Horse team and partners. And what's interesting about Front Run the Fed, who's, you know, no doorknob, Masson and Get Smokin' are going to spar, I suppose, on the front end. And Regal Glory can set up shop third. I mean, to be honest, Casa Creed is going to need a little bit of help, it seems. And for his patented one run, which is how he likes to approach things. Last year, of course, when he tried this, and he had won the Jiper, and he came running late. It was Get Stormy and Set Piece were ahead of him. So the mile is slightly different for Casa Creed than the six. And that's the that's the equation. I mean, David Aragona, I'm sure, will release the morning line. Maybe he did last night and I didn't notice, because he gets right at it, especially the Saturday cards, where everybody's interested in the headline stakes. So, I mean, Regal Glory is your favorite, your clear favorite, and Casa second choice. And Regal Glory has been just unbelievable. And I say this every time she comes out. I mean, it's great that she got to stay in the Chad Brown barn, that Peter Brandt stepped up as part of the dispersal for the late Paul Pompa. And Paul would just be absolutely loving every moment of this unbelievable mare's career. She's 12 for 19 going into this. She has, for those that haven't seen the PPs, she's 3 for 3 at Saratoga. Yeah, and 7 for 12 the mile. And she really can adjust. What's interesting about her, she can adjust to the pace. If the two go moderately in front, she'll stalk and go. If they light out a little bit, Masson and Get Smoking, she'll sit 4 or 5 lengths off and launch the run. Jose Ortiz, of course, Luis Saez, who's ridden Casa the last 4. Masson has got the services of Flavian Pratt, who won the poker with him, the Kingman gelding. Javier Castellano, who just is riding spectacularly well. And by the way, we're going to go over the results from yesterday in a second. The maddening result yesterday was... yesterday will not go down as one of the great afternoons in Spa history. Let's just put it that way. there's been some good days. There's been some bad days. This one goes... to the right of toward the not so great days. It was chaos out there yesterday. Front run the Fed, by the way, Kayo Karamori, and it's very nice. Won the Van Cleef down at Colonial, and is a super consistent type and owns a Saratoga win. So, it's 5 really good. I mean, it's a very good 4-star day. That's what's going on there is fine. The 2-year-old stake, the Saratoga special, also a 5-pack, and you do have the 2 headliners, Gulfport, the Uncle Mo colt for the Highland Brats. From the Asmussen barn, we didn't even talk about him yesterday with Steve, because there's every chance we talk about him on next week. There is Damon's Mount coming up from Colonial for Michelle Lovell, the very exciting Gervin for Cliff and Michelle Love and Lovell. It's like new on CBS this September. Love and Lovell. Damon's Mount, the smashing debut winner, who won off by a dozen. Gabe Saez. That'd be very interesting to... that's a great trivia question. Get on this, trivia folks. Is Hard Spun Gabe Saez's last Saratoga victory? In the King's Bishop? Is that possible? That's the Latin? I mean, I'm going to guess that he has won something else when he's come up here. I mean, usually he's down in the Mid-Atlantic. But Gabe Sayas comes to town. So for those that are wondering, I wonder if Gabe Sayas ever won a... Depends on how old you are. if you remember Hardspun's King's Bishop win. I'm anxious. You know, that's a funny question. Are people going to say, well, you know, when Hardspun won the Jerkins, he didn't win the Jerkins, folks. He won the King's Bishop. Let's distinguish that. But anyway, Gulfport and Damon's Mound are the two headliners. But just like in the Four Star Dave, there is another entity involved, and that's Super Chow. And boy, the only thing wrong with George Delgado's Lord Nelson colt and the beginning of his career here, he broke his maiden in July in Florida. What would make this even, you know, a better thing to talk about would be where a horse like Super Chow should have broken his maiden, which was Calder. And remember, these types would show up, right? Marty Wolfson would show up with them. Milt Wolfson would show up with them. You know, all kinds of fun. You know, 2-year-olds, they'd come out of Calder and they were hickory. That's because they were training and running in 107 degree heat. And they were. Did Calder ever cancel in the summer? And the answer is no. the answer is no. I think. I mean, maybe they did. Maybe they did. And Rich Migliori. Rich, thank you. Rich is saying, and I think he might be right. I'm thinking of Gabe Sayas because of his association with the Cowboy, with Larry Jones. But Mario Pino. Mario Pino. All right, let's go. All right, we got to do this. Let's go to the videotape. And we will make a determination. We will be determining that Tom Amos is joining us in about 8 minutes. Famous Amos. 4,000 career wins. Yeah, yesterday in that stake, in the Tale of the Cat. And isolate. I saw some people that were just mystified. Mystified. Isolate. How does that horse win? I guess nobody. Do you not look at figures? Isolate. I mean, anybody that uses Thoroughgraph, Isolate was the play. And of course, Southern District didn't show up. Let's be honest. But still, I mean, Isolate was not a surprise. Anyway, Hardspun. So Amos is going to join us and we'll celebrate his career and, we'll find out. Yeah. Good job. You're right. You're right, Rich. You're 100% right. And, when it comes to Hardspun, yeah. Mario Pino. I guess Gabe was on. On Eight Bells, and others, that King's Bishop, that was a high pressure opportunity and win. There was a huge bonus. Yeah, Mario Pino, great job, Rich Migliori, well done. Hardspun, and he went favorite. He was 6-5. And First Defense, Easy Warrior, Tufflesburg. Speaking of Calder, right? Jamie Sanders, wasn't she? She was Calder-based. Most Distinguished for Nick, Bold Start, King of the Roxy with Ramon, Longley, Pollyak, 40 Grams, and Spin Master. That was your... I guess in retrospect, 6-5 was a good price on Hardspun. he won by a length and a half. Anyway, Super Chow is very interesting in here. And you know what's interesting about too about this Saratoga special? usually at this time of year, when you look at a two-year-old steak, and we've got, you know, we've got them coming up as well at Del Mar this this weekend. Yeah, both you know, both Saratoga, Del Mar, with that similar, you know, opening weekend, mid-meet, and closing week pairs of the two-year-old races. But it's unusual to look at a group of two-year-olds like this that were, you know, either first or in fact, all five of them were first out winners. But usually this time of year, you'll get a group that, you know, four out of five are front runners. That is not the case with this group. Now, Damon's Mount, for instance, did not start particularly well, and then, you know, came to the lead. Super Chow did wire. There's Valenzen Day for the inexplicably 0-for-42 Rudy Rodriguez. I mean, one of the craziest stories. They're going to do a Saturday Night Live skit on Saturday, right? And every time you see Rudy, and you're like, Rudy, and he shrugs his shoulders. He says, "I got nothing." He says, "I got no bullets." He does have 5 seconds and 6/3. 0-for-42. It's crazy. But anyway, Valenzen Day comes from off the pace, and Rudy's going to put the blinkers on. Trevor McCarthy gets aboard because Rosario, who rode the last pair, is with Gulfport. Brian Hernandez Jr. rode the first two starts, the Maiden Breaker and the Bashford. And Gulfport didn't need the lead in his debut win. He just overpowered the Bashford. And Owen's Leap for Amos, who, you know, he'll talk about. Owen's Leap doesn't need the lead. He's adding blinkers. So it's just a little unusual that this time of year, two-year-old race, and you know, there's a variety of styles involved. So those are your stakes on Saturday, just five each, but they're both good groups. But at the same time, we just keep, you know, we keep reiterating this, and I'm not really sure why, you know, why some people stayed away. But it should be good. There's a very good, what looks like a very good 7/8 maiden race late in the card, too. Kind of an interesting placement on Saturday. The 9th race. Yeah, it's a little surprising, actually. A little unusual. The 7th as well. That's 6. The one going 7 is for older, 3 and ups. And the 2-year-olds go as the 7th. So it's a quirky, a little bit of a quirky late pick 4, pick 5. On Saturday. Looking forward to that. All right, let's also, I've got a bunch of things to do. Tony Black's going to be with us, and I'll talk in a minute about, I think it's a natural that Tony talk about yesterday's DQ and non-DQ, and I'll get to that momentarily. A quick hit about Del Mar as well. Speaking of the two-year-old races, the Sorrento. This for the two-year-old fillies on Saturday, and what looks to be, you know, a very solid, well-matched group in here too. Michael W. McCarthy for Eclipse Procrastination, the horse that you heard Aaron Wellman mention last week. This is a Not This Time filly from the rail. May be favored. Doug O'Neill's got Satin Doll, a nice congrats filly that came from well out of it. Going 5/8, no less. And Doug's also got Absolutely Zero, 2-for-2. For the Redhams, this is a homebred of theirs, Nyquist, using one of the Nyquist covers that Paul Redham retained, and so forth. There's actually one maiden in here, Infinite Diamond, Patrick Biancone for the Diamond Racing people, and a Fipke bred, a B jersey. Nice. So big opportunity. The Grade 2 Sorrento at Del Mar, and they're also going to run the Yellow ribbon, I think, right? Yeah, yellow ribbon. The mile and a 16th for the Phillies and Mares. And a lot of the usual suspects here, including Leonard Powell coming back with Avenue de France out of the Oceanitas win, Going Global, Havanika, etc. George Papa Padromo, who is... Seven for
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Thoroughbred horse racing is back in Virginia as Colonial Downs conducts its More Racing, More Money summer season presented by Woodford Reserve. An early week racing schedule and average daily purses of $625,000. The 9-week meet runs from July 11th through September 7th with racing every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1:45 p.m. Wager on Colonial's 50-cent pick 5 with a low 12% takeout and a new carryover provision. All races will be broadcast on TVG this summer. Colonial Downs racing Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1:45 p.m.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the foaling barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
I guess we'll come back in here. I think my signal dropped. This was not something we could blame on Florida. but we're back. And what was I? I don't even remember what I was riffing on. Tom Amos is going to join us. And as we do that, I want to slip in one or two stories. And of course, you know. I go to straighten the desk over and over again, and yet when it comes time to you know, have something right at the ready. It's never there. I wanted to read from the press release from the CHRB, who, after the incredibly eloquent and succinct and passionate reaction to their, you know, their idea of licensing media people, the CHRB relented yesterday evening and sent out a press release that basically acknowledged the, I don't want to say error, of their ways. the attempt at a constitution violating idea. I don't even know how to frame it. It is so preposterous. But anyway, CHRB said that there will be no licensing of media. Tom Amos, standing by and probably still aglow from winning his 4,000th race as a trainer. Tom Amos, congratulations.
Thank you, Steve. I'm very appreciative.
Well, and you, as you rightly did, Colleen gets all the credit.
Of course. And so do my two grown adult kids, Ashley and Haley. They, as any trainer will tell you, it's one of those jobs that requires a great deal of sacrifice and support from your family, and they were always there for me. We never got to share our breakfast together while the kids were growing up, but that's all they knew. So it wasn't hard for them, and I'm just so pleased that when yesterday happened, that Haley was here. And unfortunately, Ashley couldn't be because the New Orleans Pelicans are getting busy, and so that's her job, and so she's doing her thing down there.
Well, I'm just looking at the numbers, and it's actually pretty amazing. You've got the easiest career percentage to ever be calculated because you've had 16,000 starts and 4,000 wins. I'm almost exactly. It's very. Did you realize that 16,031 starts and 4,000 wins? I mean, exactly 25%.
Well, to make a confession, yes, because I'm not the first or the last guy that's going to get to 4,000 wins. I'm well aware of that, but. I thought, you know, we're not, I guess people would call us a large stable, but on the scale of large stables, we're a small, large stable. We keep about 80 horses a year, and we try not to get any bigger than that, and sometimes maybe a couple over, and sometimes we're smaller. But the one thing that I'm a real micromanager, so that's why we can't get any larger than that. And like I said, I knew that there would be many before me. I think I'm the 15th, and there'll be guys after me. So when it was starting to get close, I was like, you know what, I would really like it if I could do it and have a higher percentage than anybody, a win percentage than anybody else before me. And you know, it came yesterday at a real opportune time, and we were able to achieve that, and I'm proud of that.
Well, we'll talk about the specific and some other horses, but you know, a couple of things of note when you look at your career, and you know, you started young. I mean, you sent out your first horse at what age?
I think about 25. It was 1987. Wow. So I'm 26. I was born in 61, and it was a short stint. I was at Sportsman's Park. I had about 6 horses. And, you know, you can't make a living on 6 horses unless you're doing a lot of the work yourself and hoping to grow. And it's the dead of winter at Sportsman's. It's snowing every day. And my first win was for Maiden 7500 claim. And I remember it like it was yesterday. So I still have that picture down in my basement hanging up on a wall. It was an important win for me. It was certainly something It was, I think it was my eighth start that I won that race. And after the first seven starts, I began to wonder, am I ever going to be able to win a race? But that's how trainers think. You know, we're a pessimistic lot, you know, that tend to try to see the glass as half empty, not half full.
Well, no. Not only is it half full, but there's like a crack in the glass, and the water's dripping out the side. I mean, that's the way you guys look at stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It serves you well. When you're running in a race, you're always looking at the what ifs and did you do everything right? And you know, you're questioning yourself. At least I do. And so that spell check, your mind plays on you when you're training horses. It, like I said, it serves me well.
Tom Amos with us on the occasion of yesterday's 4,000th win. And, you know, Tom, talk about what's changed in these decades and what's changed for the better, what's changed for the worst. And I want you to also give, you know, young horsemen or prospective aspiring horsemen career advice.
Well, that's a pretty engrossing question, and I'm happy to answer it. I've always been a guy that recognized that the way I made it in this business was to have some really good teachers along the way, people that took time from their day to help me to want to become a trainer. They knew that I was dedicated to whatever job I had, and they knew I was ambitious, and they knew I was wanting to learn. I was eager to learn, and those guys were there for me. So I think if you present that when you come to the racetrack, you'll get the same. You know, it's funny. I had a kid stop me yesterday. He's finishing up college at the University of Delaware. This was before I hit 4,000, and he introduced himself. And I like helping young people. He said, you know, I'd love to talk to you. And I gave him my phone number, and we're going to talk. So, I mean, that's the way I was taught when I was brought up. You know, is to try to help others. And if I can make a difference in someone's life at the track, that's great. You know, I want to do that. But to answer the question a little more generally, I started working at the track. It was 1977 in Louisiana. If you were 15, you were old enough to drive. You get your license. And nobody's waking up in my family to take me out to the racetrack at 5 in the morning. And I did jobs, you know, Christmas break and things like that. And then when I started college, I spent a summer at Louisiana Downs working, and these are for guys that you know, really are legends in the business. Jack Vanberg, Frank Brothers, those guys. I knew once I got my degree, I was coming straight to the track. When I did graduate in 83, my mom and dad, you know, were obviously happy and proud, and they like, you know, if you'd like a little gift of some kind, you know, now it's time to ask. And I said, I would like to go to Saratoga. And so that was 1983, my first time to ever come to Saratoga. And I was introduced to the big leagues. I mean, the tracks that I worked at, which I love to this day, Fairgrounds, Louisiana Downs, tracks like that, you know, Saratoga's on a different scale. And I got to see, you know, how it works in the spotlight. And I loved it. I can recall I saw Devil's Bag break his maiden in his first start that year. The next time I came back to Saratoga was in 87. And by then I was an assistant trainer. I'd just been hired by John Parasella, who was really winning everything back then. And so I came
trained under the stars.
Yes, he is. You know what it was. Yeah. You know, and it's got to be said. So, you know, that was his label, trainer to the stars. And he was in California, and he trained for James Caan and a few others. And somehow or another, he got an appearance on The Tonight Show through that moniker, Trainer to the Stars. And so it was right before the Kentucky Derby, which is why they had him on. And the show went over, and they couldn't get to John at the end of the show. So they told him during commercial break, they said, John, we're just going to bring you out and introduce you and, you know, put you on camera. And apologize for not being able to get to you. So it's the end of the show, and Johnny Carson has him come out, and they put him on camera and said, ladies and gentlemen, John Parasella, we didn't have time to talk to you this evening, John. We just want to say hello and thank you for the great job you do as a horse trainer. And John said, Johnny, just want to say one thing. Next week, Secretariat has no chance in the Kentucky Derby. That was John's famous moment. His 15 seconds of fame. Taking the greatest horse in the world and saying he had no chance to win the Kentucky Derby. It's like dissing Michael Jordan, you know?
It's like the best.
Anyhow, so I came back in 87 and I worked for John. And an owner from Louisiana came by the barn. He knew my family and introduced himself and asked if we would like to go to dinner, my wife and I. And then we said, yeah. So we went to the Wishing Well. And, in 87, I didn't have two quarters to rub together. So to get a nice treat like that and going to a historic restaurant like the Wishing Well, you know, that was a big deal to us. And I've been going back there ever since. And I went last night on the occasion of my 4,000th win. And it was just me, my daughter Haley, and my wife Colleen. And it was a very, very special meal. And I just love how that place has never changed. And it's as much a part of Saratoga and the racetrack as anything there is around here. And I just, every time I eat there, I it's very nostalgic, and I love the food. It's a great place.
The only thing missing, I guess, last night then was Gene Stevens coming over to put a camera in your face.
Yeah, that's old school. You're going old school on everybody. Yeah.
We've mentioned that. We've mentioned Post Time USA, Gene Stevens, the Calder, and Paracella. It's the superfecta. And that's only in the first 36 minutes.
There you go.
I got a great interjection question for this too, as you expand on sort of a multi-leveled topic of your career and the way the game's changed. Chad Chexnader has got a great question, Tom, and he wanted you to riff on the fire and how much of an interruption and you know disruption for you and everybody else the fire was in what 92?
Yes. I remember that. Yeah. So the question related to the fire, I'm sorry. One of my owners asked me a quick question. You got to repeat it. I apologize.
No, just in terms of your career arc and you know what having to adjust to that and how much of a disruption it was for you and other horsemen obviously in the market over that, you know, over those winters.
So I remember it well. So the fire in 92, I was just starting to get to the point where I had enough horses. I was, you know, I'd won a couple of titles at the fairgrounds in the early 90s. And on that specific evening, I was eating at a restaurant that was very popular and called Bozo's. They had the best fried catfish in the world. And Bo's cooked the catfish himself. He was great. And we were in the restaurant, and he walked to the table. He said, hey, there's a little fire in the jocks room at the fairgrounds. He just announced it on TV. You know, it wasn't a big deal. And he came back to the table an hour later. He goes, I think something big is going on at the fairgrounds. So we finished the dinner. We drove out to the fairgrounds, and you couldn't get close because the whole building was ablaze. And the old building, and it's still there, has these concrete steps. They're like stands that you can watch. So it goes all the way across, like stands in a football field, but they're just concrete all the way up to the building. And that fire was so hot that the concrete was glowing. I just remember, look, I say this all the time. You know, if it matters, if something matters to you, it's okay to cry. I remember crying that night watching the place I grew up with that had all those little nooks and crannies, you know, just like, you know, maybe your favorite football stadium or something you used to go to as a kid. You know, I remember that was that hurt. But Brian Krantz, 2 days later, after the fire, brought everybody together in the kitchen and announced to everyone, we will be back and we will be running. And I think I think he said it was going to be 3 weeks. I remember that. And he literally saved every trainer there because, as an owner, it's really easy to move one or two horses from a guy's barn to a different track. But as a trainer, there's not a track that's going to all of a sudden make room for 50 horses. So you had no answer for owners if they were like, hey, you know, I understand the fire and everything, but I've got to make a living and my horse can go elsewhere. Now that Brian had come and told us that, we could all say, we're going to be back running in 3 weeks. And he really saved. I know he saved me, and I know he saved a lot of other trainers as well that day.
How have things changed for the better or for the worse, Tom?
Well, I think the biggest things that I look at right now and I see is potentially things that can be a real problem for the industry. I think the number one thing is, and I don't say this with any sour grapes at all, because you know I'm 60 years old. I've got a great career, and this is not affecting me. But I'm talking about things that are affecting the industry. We're seeing a real migration of horses going to, you know, big trainers, bigger than me, of course. And then we're seeing the middle-sized trainers getting smaller, and we're seeing some of the smaller trainers, they're leaving the business. And with such a conglomeration of horses in few spots with these trainers, when the races are written that we enter in, those guys have all the cards. They might have three or four for a specific spot, and they're not going to enter three or four in that race. So it makes for smaller fields. And the smaller fields make for less betting, because that's just the way the game works. And less betting means less purses. And I'm worried about the effect that that's having on the industry. We're experiencing it for sure at Saratoga right now. And, you know, to me, we've got to find a way for the small guys to stay in business, even if that means, and look, it's above my pay grade. So what I'm going to throw out there now is just an idea, and I haven't evaluated. But even if that means finding a way for them to be more competitive with the bigger guys by being offering maybe a lower day rate because they're getting a little supplement from the tracks or something like that to stay in business. And I don't know where you draw the line on that supplement or how you handle it or anything, but I just feel like we've got to have as many stables as possible to compete, because it increases field size. You know, it's artificially being increased in California right now with this Win and Your In program. But, you know, the Win and Your In program in California is a lot like, you know, the PPP loans we were getting as small businesses when COVID hit. I mean, eventually you got to pay the rent, you know, and when you pay the rent, you know, the bottom falls out. So that's a great idea for the short term, but in the long term, it's not going to work. So we've got to find a way to make the smaller trainers competitive, and the guys that want to become trainers, a way to make them competitive. And sometimes day rate's the way to do that. But in today's world, you know, commodity prices and everything as they are, they can't do it without some help. And again, that's just an idea. I don't want anybody to look at that and say, well, you know, and punch holes in it, because I'm sure they could. But again, it's above my pay grade.
How I don't know, from a scale of 1 to 10, how positive are you about where we are right now and the direction of the game overall? And granted, this is a feels like a transitory period where this HISA is going to have some, you know, right now it's still kind of amorphic, but it's going to take shape soon enough and you know, be part of the firmament. So how hopeful are you? I mean, if you had a son that was thinking about coming into the game, you know, would you steer him clear or would you welcome him in?
So, look, I think HISA, and I'm going to use a term, I think it's a grand experiment. I don't mean grand wonderful. I mean grand big. It's a big experiment that is going to happen, and you can't fight City Hall. And so how it's implemented and how it goes, you know, we're going to have to see. And it's not going to be without its stumbling blocks, I'm certain. But I do think that, you know, horse racing has brought this on itself. You know, the jurisdictions don't want to do anything that doesn't help them specifically instead of the whole. And I really feel like the industry is left with no choice. I mean, in the end, the thing that I find really, really frustrating in the industry is, you know, everybody's got a voice. The owners certainly have a voice, the jockeys and the trainers. But you know who doesn't have a voice is the bettors. And the bettors make the world go round. I mean, if they're not betting money, then the prices at the sales drop. Everything changes, you know, and the bettors need to be first and foremost in the mind of the industry. And I think a lot of times that's forgotten. And I'm not going to go into examples of how that's occurred in the last year, but it certainly has been enough of a headline here and there when it happens for everybody to know.
No doubt. And, you know, you could even make the case that, you know, the last week, 10 days, players have been, you know, ill-served by the way in which stewards are handling things, and we're ill-served by, you know, the inability to time races industry-wide. And, I mean, it's so many other, we've been hashing this stuff up kind of nonstop. I mean, sometimes I don't focus on and dwell on some of these issues. But I mean, when you know, when they're a steady, it's one thing when the bathroom sink is the occasional drip, but when you're laying there in bed and all you hear is the drip, 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 it, you know, after a while you got to get out of bed and take a wrench to the thing.
Right,
you know.
I don't disagree. I mean, so I'm as a trainer, yeah, okay. I've already said I'm a pessimistic guy, and I'm not trying to be a 180 on this, but I've got great hopes for our industry in its future. You know, I mean, the country as a whole has embraced you know, betting. Look at any of these, you know, DraftKings, et cetera, the NFL now, when they're doing their shows, is telling you what the line is on a game. Same goes for basketball. They were probably one of the first to embrace it. And so I think horse racing has a place there. And I think it's going to make a big difference. And so I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic, but I do think there's some big problems that the industry has to come together and fix. And I'm hopeful that people see it as something that will benefit everyone, not just their certain jurisdiction, which is how these tracks have operated in the past.
Yeah, well framed. Tom Amos with us, 4,000 wins as of yesterday, and I'm going to ask about a couple of horses, including the special runner on Saturday. But before I do that, Tom, what moment in the career arc, what horse made you think to yourself, I'm going to be a success in this game, and what horse, you know, sort of made you think I can be, you know, as big time as I want to be?
Well, I think number one, you have to recognize that you're not going to be anything if you don't have supportive owners, and I certainly had great support through the years, but they're the ones that put the biggest investment in the game, and they're the ones that bring you the athletes. So my first big break in horse racing is actually kind of an ironic story, because it happened at Louisiana Downs in 1988. And I had gotten one owner, and he was volatile. He'd switched trainers a lot, so I knew he was probably short-term. And then I had two other horses. And one of the two other horses was a horse that I'd pieced together with eight people, $2,000 each, and we bought. He broke his maiden at a low level at Fairgrounds. We bought him off of that win. And I thought there was something there. And we brought him to Louisiana Downs, and we won a minor claiming race. And then all of a sudden, this big stake race came up. And the significance of the big stake race was that it was a mile and an eighth, which is a lot of distance for horses down there. And this horse definitely had stamina. So I entered one horse for my owner, who was, like I said, fairly volatile. His nickname was Crete, like concrete. And the reason they called him Crete was because his family had all the highway contracts in Louisiana for concrete. But they also called him Crete because he was very hard-headed. And so I had his horse in the race, and he was the favorite. And there was a question as to whether he'd get the distance. And then I put this outlier in named Fire the Shot. And they ran the race that day, and Fire the Shot won. And back then, long before you could watch races on TV or on your phone or anything like that, the only way you knew the results of a race was if you were at the track or got the paper the next day. So they would lock up the phones on the backside of the racetrack back then before the first race and unlock them at the end of the day. And this was the feature race. It was my first stakes win with Fire the Shot. And we were celebrating in the grandstand, and When the last race ended, I went back to the barn to check on the two horses, Fire the Shot, who had won, and this other horse that Crete owned. And when I got back to the barn, I had hired a kid who was my one employee that was just on summer break. Fire the Shot. He goes, oh, yeah, he called. And I said, well, what did he say? He goes, well, he asked how he did, and I told him he won. I said, no, his horse didn't win. The other horse won. And he's like, and he didn't know any better. And so he said, well, he said he's going to call you back. So I literally went in my office, and I sat down, and I looked at that phone like it was a ticking time bomb. And when the ticking time bomb went off and the phone rang, I answered, and he said, hey, Tom, we won it, huh? And I said, no, we were fourth. And the guy was no dummy, and he goes, really? Where did that other horse of yours that you ran against me run? And I said, he won, you know? And he said one word after that, and that was, huh. And in Louisiana, huh means you're fired. And I was down to three horses after that. So I went home, and I told Colleen, I said, we're through. You know, I can't make it on three horses. It's going to be the shortest training career ever. But the race caught the attention of one of the nation's biggest owners who lived in Shreveport, John Franks. And sure. Mr. Franks called me the next day and said, would you take a few horses for me? And I said, yes. So he gave me three horses, and in the next 3 to 4 weeks, I ran all three of them, and all three of them won. And he flooded me with horses after that. That was my break, and that was when I knew I was going to be okay. There you go. You said it too. Does that mean you get me off the phone?
No, because I've got more. I'm carrying you to the wire. Actually, Heritage of Gold. Heritage of Gold was the horse that I kind of said, oh, all right, Tom Amos. All right, for whatever reason I remember.
My first grade one happened right here at Saratoga. Heritage of Gold. Yeah, won the Go for One. Yeah, that was a big day. That was a really big day. So she was easy to train. I mean, everything about her was straightforward. Never had any leg issues. I really enjoyed working with her. So all good there. She was a pleasure. I loved her. She ran third in the Breeders' Cup Distaff twice. She was one of those rare horses that put the bridle on. She did anything you wanted her to do.
Obviously Derby, outside of the Kentucky Derby, what is there left for you to do in this sport?
Oh gosh, you know, I don't look at it like that, but I think there's plenty, you know. I love working with horses. I love working with animals. And, you know, to be able to do that every morning and come out here and work with the horses, I mean, I don't know. I think that's why guys do it for so long past their 60th birthday, because it's a way of life, and you enjoy working with the horses.
Speaking of which, it's really a testament to you as a citizen of New Orleans and one of the first families of NOLA that I'm getting all these notes. Michael Bacik writing Mike saying about the horse you ran yesterday at Indy for Chris Ewing's wife Karen, and you know it. You and I have had some very personal conversations, Tom. It's one of the disappointments that I couldn't be at the track this morning. The occasion when your dad was ailing and. It's a very personal, it seems to me that particularly in New Orleans, the horseman community, the owner community, the horse player community, it's as interpersonal there as anywhere in the country.
I agree with that. You mentioned Chris. Chris was one of my closest friends, and he one day, it was right before his birthday, right before his 62nd birthday, and the next day he was flying up to celebrate his birthday and opening weekend at Keeneland with me, and he was in his office, and he had a massive heart attack, and he was gone. And I remember getting the phone call, I was on the road driving the Indy for the races that afternoon from Louisville, and the phone rang, and a close friend of his called me and told me, and I stopped the car, I turned it around, and I went home. You know, it was a tough day, and it's been tough. His wife, Karen, has already been up here for the meet to visit us. She's a really wonderful, strong lady. But specifically of Chris, that's a man that was bigger than life. I mean, when you met Chris, you were like, I want to be this guy's friend, because he really took a bite of the apple out of life. I mean, he always had fun. He was always, you know, the life of the party. And I miss him a lot, you know. But that, I think a lot of that comes with age, right? I mean, both my parents have passed in the last 2 years. I had a brother that was diagnosed with Parkinson's. There's six of us. And, you know, I watched it take him, and he's gone now as well, and that's recent. And you know, life is, that's the story of life. You know, when you get to be my age, you recognize you're not invincible anymore, and that, you know, you count your blessing and you live your days right. I'm getting a little too philosophical, sorry.
Well, it's appropriate and you know, fitting. I mention every year, particularly at the start of the in November, at the start of fairground season, there's no racetrack in the country that has more memorial races. None, because of the, you know, the way in which you know, everyone interacts and how I mean, from my experience, just you know, how ingrained horseplay and horsemanship and what the racetrack is in, you know, in New Orleans and Louisiana, and it to me it's really touching and remarkable, and more places should do it, I imagine. But you know, you think about all the it's such a great variety too, Tom. It's characters, media personalities, horsemen, track management, you name it. I mean, it's a community that supports each other in a very unique way. There's no place, honestly, as many places as I go, there's no place like racing in New Orleans.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm proud that I'm from there, and I'm proud of the fairgrounds, and specifically, I mean, the barn I operate out of is the first barn I had a job in as a hot walker, going back to the late 70s.
Wow.
So, I operate out of the same barn, and I think it's as far as the people there. I think not only the racetrack people, but the town itself is a very welcoming town. People are kind to one another, and they open their door to strangers. It's just like I said, New Orleans is a place all its own.
Well, Tom, 4,000 wins, and there's no reason why there won't be 5,000 or more. You've been winning at the same rate for for close to 30 years, and it'll continue. And then you get to share, you know, the fact that you share these summers with everybody on the broadcast team. It's such a great enhancement and addition to the coverage.
I appreciate that. I'm proud of that show. I'm just a small part of it. I think I you know, bring something to the table there. But on both sides of the camera, it's a really, really good show. Put it back in. Yeah. Sorry, I'm just looking at a horse real quick.
Well, finally, let's give everybody. She's not, you know, it's not going to be another Venti Valentine, but how about Owen's leap? How about Owen's leap on Saturday?
Oh, well, he's going to have to leap. I mean, that is a really, really good race. I watched Gulfport break his maiden at Churchill Downs. I thought he was the most impressive 2-year-old to do so. And then I ran second, well behind him, in the Bashford Manor with Owen's leap. And so, you know, for us to take that step forward that Owen's leap has to take, he's training great, but Gulfport's going to have to come back to us. So I think that's a tough ask. So we'll see how it goes. But on Sunday is Ellis Park's big day, and they run the debutante and the juvenile. And you know, in the debutante, I'm going to run Holiday Decision, who's doing very, very well. And in the juvenile, I'm going to run a horse that I ran up here at Saratoga and got stuck down the rail. I think it was one of those days on the rail. And that's a horse named Curly Jack. I'm excited about those horses.
Excellent. They'll draw that card today, and we'll talk to Marty McGee about it tomorrow. And I do want to ask you as well, Tom, about this Firster, the West Coast Colt, the two-year-old out of Alcatraz at Indianapolis.
So that race has been taken off the grass, disappointingly, because he has a great pedigree for turf. But, you know, we're going to run. I mean, the race will do him good, but he's got a really strong page for turf, and that'll be some other time.
Okay. All right. I just caught my eye, and we haven't seen many West Coasts. And, you know, so. Well, Tom, this was wonderful, and we always have rambling and discussions. That's all right. No, listen, everybody loves it, and everybody loves you, and I appreciate this and continued success.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Tom Amos, everybody, and really a wonderful. On every front, somebody that explains the game in great terms. He's a great communicator, and frankly, that probably counts a lot toward the success that he's had for all this for all this time. You look at his numbers. He basically has started between 450 and 600 horses for 25 years, and has won at 25% basically that whole time. And the majority of his, and we've discussed this, the majority of his for an extended period was at somewhat lower levels, sort of bread and butter, meat and potato levels. When state courses have come along, he's had, stakes, high level stakes success, obviously, and most recently, I suppose, Serengeti, the, Serengeti Empress, Joel Politi. I could have asked him, about his, some of the other owners, the recent, but Dr. Politi, undoubtedly, the stint with the Bensons. With Tom Benson, and boy, that you want to talk about, talk about an ill-timed loss for, not just for New Orleans. I was actually in New Orleans. We were at the HBPA convention the day that Tom Benson died, and that was I will not forget that. And in fact, I'm sure if I pulled up the archives, I imagine that Tom was on. We had a few conversations, Al Stahl and Tom. Anyway, Tom Amos, if you missed part of it, or if you came in, or you had to step away, try to catch the whole thing. He was fabulous, and I put up a picture. I had to because I have that very funny. Picture the last time we saw Paracella, and I actually owe John a segment because he's got a book. He wrote an autobiography, and we were supposed to have him on. Gosh, it's during. I'm sure it's during pandemic, and so we should really chase Paracella down. But there's a great picture from Winslow's that I just put up, and. We were at Winslow's, and there was John with Gary Gullo and Bruce Levine. So I said, "Here, you guys got to get together." I took a picture, and I love doing that. That picture. Speaking of which, that picture I very similar situation the other day in the racing office. I was sitting there and was sitting with Shug, and Angel Cordero came in, and I was getting ready to get up to go do something, and Angel sat down with Shug, and I realized I got to get a picture of the two of them. And the thing is, people just went nuts. I put it on Facebook, and I think I put it on Twitter, but on Facebook, I mean, the people just, you know, gushing. To be honest, I mean, if you asked around here, in particular, you went and took a survey, Saratoga cross section. You know, who's your favorite trainer? Shug's gonna come out in the top three of every polling, and who's your favorite jock all time? And Angel's gonna win that. I suppose that would be. I'm not somebody. Andy Serling could help with this. I'm not a statistical. I never. Actually, I think I did take a statistics course. Ron Halcrow at Colgate. I think I did, and I know I got a C, because I think I took three economics courses, and I never got higher than a C in any of them. But statistically, I'm sure it would be skewed by the age groups. But Angel, certainly people of a certain age, Angel would win the polling. So I put Angel and Shug together like that. Ron Halcrow, of all people to come up on the show. Ronnie Halcrow was a champion speed skater and was on the Olympic team that had to boycott the Olympics. Right? Is that Moscow? Right? I think so. You never know what oddity is going to come up on the show. Casey, should we take the break here and sort of keep the train on the tracks? We got a lot to do. I got Kim Weir is going to come in and urge you to attend next week's barbecue at the barn. Tony Black is coming through. Joe Clancy. We got to get to Rich Eng. We haven't talked to Rich Eng in weeks, so we got to get Rich in here. T. Pletch owes us a visit. And speaking of Gary Gullo, there's a chance that we're going to get TJ Gullo on, because I want TJ to tell you more about the farm. Let's take the time out, and Casey says break. We'll come back. There we go. Johnny Carson-esque, right? That's what we like. That was funny, telling the famous Paracella story. Traitor to the stars. I guess this gives me 2 minutes or more to, and we'll discuss it with Tony Black in terms of the two stewards issues. Wednesday. There we go. I mentioned yesterday was crazed. You had a nice upset. In fact, Joe Clancy can take a bow, because he picked the 8-1 winner in the 6-horse field. Longest shot on the board in the jump race allowance. Yeah, with Tom Garner for Mrs. Johnston. Todd Wyatt started the day. Among the craziness, you had a ton of gates. What do we have? Three gate scratches? Three gate scratches yesterday. We had jocks being dropped. You had, should check with Jenna Antonucci. Her ready seat go bled. You had the kamikaze, I mean, the Hirohito of the racetrack, Irad Ortiz, like a ballistic missile, taking a left turn out of the gate in that maiden race, basically taking out all of the field. But that's okay. We'll let it stand. No change. Okay. It's unbelievable. Now, it was messy because a couple of horses on the interior, they came to the right, and it sort of brought the whole field together. But, come on. All right. So from there, things actually settled down for the most part for at least a half an hour. It's unbelievable. Bill Parcells with a big win. Rosario on that cross-traffic filly, Maple Leaf Mel. I didn't check a fig, but she ran very well. Then came the DQ, which personally cost me probably $3,000. And I'm not going to be shy. This is the second DQ that, you know, has quashed a ticket. I'm getting a little tzehitz, as we say in Yiddish. Montatham, it was, listen, did he clip heels? Did he? Yes, he did, and I understand, but God, that was tough. Then Isolate, and the rest of the action. Crazy day. A crazy, crazy day yesterday. You could go a whole meet, and all the things that happened might not happen. Let's take a break. Yes, Rich McLeori, you're right. Back after this. We've got a fun morning started.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Thoroughbred horse racing is back in Virginia as Colonial Downs conducts its More Racing, More Money summer season presented by Woodford Reserve. An early week racing schedule and average daily purses of $625,000. The 9-week meet runs from July 11th through September 7th with racing every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1:45 p.m. Wager on Colonial's 50-cent pick 5 with a low 12% takeout and a new carryover provision. All races will be broadcast on TVG this summer. Colonial Downs racing Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1:45 p.m.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire, Maryland's 5/8 mile training track.